This is the Maestoso movement, the beginning of Opus 111 of Beethoven, Beethoven's last piano sonata. I'm Guy Livingston. I'm a concert pianist, and this is a program about silence. And I think one of the key silences in Western classical music is this beginning of this piece. There's a kind of a fanfare. Ba ba da da dum. Pause. Bom. Pause. And then a big arpeggio going up. And then a huge long rest. And then it starts over again in another key. And that's how Beethoven begins the sonata. It's wild. It's strange. It's unexpected. Beethoven is trying to create a fanfare, but a fanfare that's not only about the notes, that creates spaces, a space of suspension, anticipation, and curiosity for what is coming next. Welcome to The Silence in Between. I'm Guy Livingston. I'm a musician, and I've been playing piano for many years. So I'm passionate about sound. But what about silence? It seems to me that music wouldn't exist without it. When I think about that Beethoven sonata, it seems like the silences might be almost more important than the notes. Is that possible? So I've decided to go on a quest for silence. In this show, we'll meet a violinist who's losing her hearing, a scientist who works in one of the quietest rooms on earth, a radio host who discovered silence in Paris, and an astronaut who spent 520 days in isolation to simulate a mission to Mars. I'll search for silences in music and explore even further, looking for silence on earth and in outer space. This is my quest to find out why silence is so important. Here's poet and former BBC radio producer, Sean Street.
You sit in the middle of an empty field and think you're hearing silence. Listen to a recording of that and you're hearing the air going on around you. You're hearing the air. You're hearing a distant dog bark. There are as many kinds of silence, as Thomas Hardy has said, as there are shades of the colour white. It proves the point, doesn't it, really? It proves the point that your brain can invoke stillness inside you.
We're listening to music of the French medieval composer Perrotin. He wrote this specifically for the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris. At the time, rests were not notated in paper. In fact, even the music was not notated. There was a lot of improvisation and a lot of memorization. So the rests depended on the space in which the music was sung, hence on the reverberance of the building itself. And Notre Dame was an enormous building, the largest church in Europe. Spaces were deliberately left in the music because the building was so big that every sound would echo and echo off the stone pillars and the plaster ceiling. The musical pauses were known as media distinctio. This was a natural way to let the music breathe. A I used to think there's just one kind of silence. Silence is a rest. It's a space. It's the absence of sound. But then I began this search for silence. So the show is not really about silence. It's about silences. Because as soon as you start listening to different kinds of music, thinking about what silence means for different composers, then you start to realize there are three or four different kinds of silence, and then, actually, there are dozens of kinds of silence. There's the silence of surprise, the silence of suspense, the silence of loss or regret. There are silences for waiting, for expectation, for anticipation. We listen with bated breath or on the edge of our seats. There is the repose between movements or the rapt attention before applause. I'm going to play two versions of a piece by the Estonian composer Arvo Pärt. Here's Psalm, performed by the NYYD Quartet. Here's the same piece by Arvo Pärt, but played by a saxophone quartet, the Alia Saxophone Quartet. Notice how the silences are different, less austere. Indeed, this version has more reverberance. Ironically, the silences allow you to hear the building around them, which is obviously a grand and echoey space. These 20th century silences remind me of the medieval silences, of the media distinctio, which we heard earlier in the music of Perrotin. And silence goes far beyond music. What about the silence on a morning of thick snow, or the calm before the storm? The silence of the forest is not the same as the silence in the desert. What about the eerie electric silence in the eye of a hurricane? Could it be that these silences we experience in nature give us insight into musical silences? And can silence help us to understand death, the ultimate silence? We speak of the silence of the grave, or we joke about an awkward silence, or we talk about a pregnant pause. So as I begin this quest, I feel like I'm starting to hear more and more types of silence. How will those translate into music? Music could provide a remarkable way of interpreting those silences. I started with Beethoven, but I'll experiment, trying examples from Monteverdi, Haydn, Mahler, and Cage. Along the way, I'll venture out into silences underground and beyond the earth, and we'll see about the silence in outer space.
The general level of sound in the world has gone up dramatically.
We find it very difficult to listen to silence now because we are surrounded by sound.
And not just on the street with more cars or motorcycles or any of the things you might hear in the background. It's the over availability of sound in our world. We are swamped with sound. We are overstimulated in our life. What does a large amount of sound at a sustained amount of time do to a person? And is that something we should be worried about? I'm Monica Germino, and I play the violin. I'm from Charlottesville, Virginia. I'd found my direction by the time I was in my senior year at NEC, and I went to Yale to study contemporary music.
That's Monica Germino, famous avant-garde violinist. She's a close friend of mine, and I went to many of her concerts. Though classically trained, she was like a rock star. Her shows were loud, sexy, exciting, sensational. But years of playing in orchestras and on stage in bands had damaged her hearing.
What's the best way to talk about this? Because I was pretty much one of the loudest violinists that I knew anyway in Holland. What's loud? Well, I played amplified and I had an electric violin that I also used. I mean, I played 35 concerts playing two bass drums behind me and electric violin. I was not as careful as I could have been. I desperately want to do something to make this subject less taboo, but considering the amount of mail and letters I get from people, from musicians that I don't know, and it's saddening because every letter and every mail, which I of course keep private, starts with that. Please keep this private. Please, this is confidential. Please don't tell anyone. Because everyone is scared, they're terrified that they'll lose their job or lose their reputation if they have any kind of hearing problem or disorder. If you go to hear Bruckner in Concertgebouw or Mahler, the orchestras have become so enormous. The strings have changed from gut to silver. The instruments themselves are now made of metal instead of wood. In the level of sound produced by instruments or orchestras, it's gone up. And I had a job in an orchestra. They said everybody gets a free hearing test. So we all went in and got our free hearing test. And they called me back in. And they said, you know, you have noise-induced hearing loss. And it can actually be painful, such as when you unload a dishwasher and you put two plates next to each other in a stack. That sound would make me flinch. So I had to leave the orchestra. I just was perplexed and upset, and it was very hard, of course, and I could not imagine sacrificing my hearing in order to stay in an orchestra. So that was it. Being hurt by sound, that's still there. When it's unexpected and I'm shocked by it, things really hurt.
The This is Monica Cimino playing electric violin a few years ago.
When I first noticed ringing in my ear, there's a constant high sort of what you call raus in Dutch, white noise kind of, but it has a tone and it's very high and it's always there.
Is it a pitch?
I can't sing it because it's so high, but it's... I think that's a B flat. Or an A. My absolute pitch has become kind of weird with this whole development.
I didn't see Monica Cimino again for many years. But when I did, her life had completely changed. A different sort of silence in music is one of control, of suspension. The composer Claudio Monteverdi uses this to great effect in his opera Orfeo. The opera tells the story of Orpheus's adventures in the underworld. In the prologue, the mythical character of La Musica tells us that she can control human feelings and that she even has power over all of nature. I like that Monteverdi here is actually, he's playing with the concept. He has music, the character of music, talking to us, using music to tell us how important music is. And she uses silence. Here's what she's singing. While my songs alternate, now happy, now sad, let no small bird stir amongst these trees, no noisy wave be heard on these riverbanks, and let each little breeze come to a stop. And lo and behold, Monteverdi actually stops. There is a long rest, which must have horrified audiences of the time. That's an aria from the Monteverdi opera, Orfeo, sung by Nathalie Desai. When she stops the music, the world stops. Let's move forward about 100 years to music of Joseph Haydn, his so-called joke quartet. I like this piece for its comic use of silence. After all, anyone who's ever told a good joke knows that the secret is in the timing. You have to feel just exactly how much of a pause to leave before the punchline. The silliness comes from the repetition and then the sudden pratfall of the stops. At first, they are unexpected. Then we begin to expect them. And then he fools us with a false ending. That's a humorous use of silence by the composer Joseph Haydn. I'm Guy Livingston, and this is a program about silence in music. So how is silence used in music, not just as a joke? Could it be catharsis? Here's poet and former radio host Sean Street.
My name is Sean Street. I'm Emeritus Professor of Radio at Bournemouth University, and I currently live in Liverpool. I have a recollection. When I was just before I was 21 years old, in May 1967, about a month before my 21st birthday, I was living in Paris. I went to a concert at Notre-Dame de Paris, Fauré's Requiem and Bruckner's Te Deum. I remember the Bruckner particularly, because the last moments of the Bruckner, the sound blazes out. It absolutely blazes out. And the building was an instrument. The building was joining in. And you only realise that when the music stopped. At the end, there seemed to be this huge reverberation that seemed to go on and on and on. And was it as long as I remembered? Surely not. I remember us all sitting there before applause, because everybody just sat stunned listening to this sound fading into silence and the building and into the crannies of the building, into the nooks and crannies far up above us and far beyond us and into the dark shadows that we couldn't see. The sound still filtering through like mercury, like water. And eventually silence came and we waited, and then we didn't want to break that silence, but we did with applause because it was sensational. I always wondered for years, because I've held that in my mind all those years, was that as long as it was? The next time I really thought about that was the night Notre Dame burned, and I was in a motel on a motorway travelling between London and Liverpool, and I was spending the night there, and I switched on the television, and like everybody I just sat aghast as I watched the flames burn. And I just thought back to that moment, and I thought of that acoustic that I could see being destroyed in front of me. And I on a whim, I went online and looked on eBay and looked on online to see if I could get a recording of that night. Did it exist? Did my memory exist? Was it? Had it been recorded? And it had. And I found a recording of it. And I sent for it, and I've got it. So immediately, just before talking to you, I sat down and timed it. Timed the reverberation as it is on the disc, which is probably not a true representation, not as perhaps as strong as it would have been in the building itself. And it's between 4 and 5 seconds. And then the silence. But it's enough to remind me of that building contributing to the piece and the silence after it.
This is the vinyl recording that Sean Street found from Notre Dame all those many years ago. We just heard the closing silence of the Bruckner Te Deum from a live performance at Notre Dame in Paris on May 18, 1967. Poet Sean Street was there and brings the event back vividly. This is the most basic kind of silence in music. It's the silence of an ending, the silence after the excitement of a performance, that marvelous feeling of having been through a moving experience in a large space with a community of people, performance and audience all poised on the edge of their seats at the end, no one yet daring to applaud because the emotions are just too strong, too powerful. And then suddenly, the actual wave of applause as we find catharsis. We're listening to Mahler's Second Symphony. It has some spectacular silences. This is the start of a huge crescendo. Keep listening, because just after the crescendo comes to its smashing climax, you'll hear a startling silence. 3 seconds. The cymbals and trumpets will still be ringing in your ears. Remember, this is the Resurrection Symphony. Thank you. You know what that reminds me of? The last Beethoven piano sonata, Opus 111. So we're listening to Mahler, and now he starts the crescendo again. In my search for the meaning of musical stillness, I spent a lot of time listening to this Mahler symphony, and I was fascinated by his use of unexpected but obviously very deliberate silences. That's the end of the first movement. After those scary silences, it ends with a small, oddly offbeat silence. This uncomfortable pause implies more, and indeed, more is coming. That was the SWR Symphony Orchestra of Stuttgart performing Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 2 in C minor, The Resurrection. Now let's go back to the story of Monica Gimeno, who quit the violin after she developed hearing problems.
So then I decided to stop. And I started canceling concerts and I started finding replacements. And I was calling people and doing the business of replacing myself, because everyone is replaceable, no matter what we think. And this was a heartbreaking and difficult time. And I don't wish that on my worst enemy, because everything you know has been taken from you. I had already said, I'd already said goodbye to the violin. And I was walking down the river in New York, the Hudson River, with Julia Wolf and her dog. And I said, well, Julia, I've already said goodbye to the violin. And I'll never forget this. In her dry, sweet voice, she said, well, say hello again. And I couldn't believe it. I almost thought, that's a little presumptuous. Everybody's trying to make me do this. And then David Lang joined. He would look at me with these gigantic eyes he has, and he would say, I see this as an enormous opportunity. And I wanted to punch him, and he knew that.
So Monica commissioned a new kind of violin, a quiet violin, inspired by 17th century models and created to explore the world of smaller sounds. It's a cool-looking instrument. From a distance, it looks hyper-modern with a high-tech neck vest, clean lines, and a long, narrow shape instead of the traditional curves of the violin.
In fact, I should probably get it out.
That would be lovely.
Okay. It deviates in many ways from the standard violin, not only from the shape, just sort of like a boat. And it has a lot of portholes on the right side. That's where the sound escapes. So it has all of these magical things that help it be what it is. Yeah, it's fabulous.
It's hilarious.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful, both.
Yes, it is beautiful.
This radical new, almost silent instrument is called the Whisper Violin.
I'm going to put this down because I tend to play with it and look at it instead of...
I don't mind, actually. It's great. Can I hold it?
I can put it on the table. You can hold
it's
it.
It's just gorgeous.
Isn't it?
It's so funny. And I didn't see it first, but when you see it from the other side, it's like a sumo wrestler.
Yeah.
It's hilarious.
Well, you know why? Because the bridge kept having to be heavier to make a sound better.
What's it made of?
So
is that plastic?
This is 3D printed. So I don't know
That's
what
hilarious.
The material
is. So you've got like super, Baroque style, old school, and then also like high tech.
Yeah, this is so high tech. And this also, the pegs are extremely high tech. The intimacy and the silence and the quiet and getting close to an audience. So being able to do that, being able to get extremely close to someone during the performance, and people have cried, hugged themselves, all sorts of reactions, the emotional response to something extremely silent and quiet next to you, being shared just with you, is on a whole different level.
Here's poet and radio historian Sean Street.
So my first memory of silence. Well, I was going to say I don't know that I've ever actually heard silence. That's not to say it doesn't exist, but myself, have I actually heard it? Well, there is, I suppose the nearest I can come to it was many years ago. I was working as a continuity announcer at BBC Radio 3. At that time, this is a long time ago, we had to broadcast programs that were partly in stereo and partly in mono. And if you were broadcasting a mono program, between the mono program and the stereo program, you had to pause as an announcer to allow for what they called a switching pause. It was a switching pause. And you had to just create dead air. And it was written into your continuity script. Pause for 15 seconds. And that, I mean, it only took a microsecond for the engineers somewhere to switch the transmitters to stereo, but you didn't know when they were going to do it, so you had to pause for 15 seconds. So I sat there for 15 seconds between, I don't know, a poetry talk and a Benjamin Britten string quartet, and sat and sat and sat. And I promise you, it seemed to me to be the longest silence I've ever witnessed, partly because I was conscious that I was live on air. And this was a live silence, that people were listening to this silence just as they were listening to my words on either side of it. And it was terrifying, because the responsibility to break the silence, to break that silence, it's a silence, you see, it's such a subtle thing. The very fact that we talk about breaking it implies that it's a thing that can be smashed. So that was, I suppose, the first experience I had that I can think of a conscious silence.
Of course, today that would be inconceivable. Listeners would assume you'd gone off the air. Indeed, most radio stations now have a silence alarm. After 3 or 4 seconds of dead air, the alarm notifies the station manager that something is wrong. Silence has become an emergency. There was one composer who did not experience silence as either comical nor dramatic, and certainly not as an emergency. That was John Cage. Not only did he love silence, but he actually wrote a composition in which nothing is played. This is famously named after its duration, 4 minutes and 33 seconds. Yes, that's the title of the piece, 4 minutes and 33 seconds. Yeah. At the premiere, the pianist, David Tudor, sat down at the piano and did absolutely nothing. Well, actually, he did something in order to mark the 3 movements which John Cage had requested. David opened and closed the lid of the piano 3 times. Here's Sean Street again.
I've been to a performance of 4 minutes 33 seconds myself, but I also think that really, I think when I listen to it, I'm aware of the gradual silence of anticipation in an audience that then grows restive.
I've performed the piece as a pianist myself. It's difficult, even as the performer, not to grow restive. Doing nothing on stage certainly doesn't come naturally, at least not to me. Where did Cage get the idea for this silence piece? He visited an anechoic chamber. That's an absolutely silent room.
When he went into an anechoic chamber expecting to hear silence, he complained that he didn't hear silence. He heard a high-pitched whistle and a low hum. And it was only afterwards that it was explained to him that he was listening to himself. The high-pitched whistle was his nervous system, and the low hum was his blood circulating. So he's literally listening to himself.
John Cage realized that sound was always going on around us. He was aware that 4 minutes and 33 seconds wasn't actually really about just silence. I listen to it every day, he said, and I realize that it's going on continuously. And that discovery of his came through the anechoic chamber.
I don't think it was his nervous system what he heard. but it was very, very interesting. There's a whole lot of different opinions on what it might have been that he heard. Some people say it was a tinnitus, some other. I think the heartbeat you can probably hear, you know, if you're in a moment of a high heartbeat. You might be able to hear that, but no, I think nervous system, I don't think so.
In order to find out more about silence and sound, I went to meet Luis Rollo. He's an antenna engineer at the European Space Agency. He spends a large part of his time setting up experiments in an enormous room called the Hertz Chamber. The idea is that no sound waves or radio waves get in, and none get out.
My name is Luis Rollo. I'm an antenna engineer, and I work for the European Space Agency. It's blue. All its walls are covered with blue pyramids with black tips. These pyramids are made of foam. They are urethane foam. They are cut into shape and then squeezed, and then put in a carbon loaded solution bath. And the fact that these walls are completely covered into these pyramids allow us to make measurements as if the antenna or the satellite would be in free space, meaning no reflections anywhere.
When the Hertz anechoic chamber was built in the 1990s, it was the largest one in Europe. It's 25 meters long, 16 meters wide, and 10 meters high. It's designed to keep out all radio waves. So between the walls is a metal grid, a so-called phoratic cage, which isolates the room from all Wi-Fi and radio signals. To give you an idea just how big the space is, the doors are 6 meters high. You could drive a trailer truck with a spacecraft on it straight into the room and park it in the middle.
And when you put it in the context of an anechoic chamber, I mean, for us, for me, you know, if I'm a very hands-on person, so when I'm doing tests here, when you come in to do a particular task and you leave everything else outside, it's a part of my job that I like a lot. In fact, you can't be reached by phone. You can't bring your laptop because there's no Wi-Fi. So, you know, all the bustling of our engineering work stays outside. So you're very focused on something here. There's a certain amount of silence because of that. So you keep that out. You can focus on this. And it's very interesting that sometimes you find yourself being, you know, reflecting more about what you're doing, because you have the space, mental space, to do that. But it's interesting that you reflect more in a room without reflections. You do feel, when you go in, you do feel a certain difference in pressure in your ears. I have to say, you get pretty much used to it after a while. Yes, it's very different from noise, because noise is there and silence is like the absence of something. That's how it feels, at least. Silence is about the lack of reflections. Oh, this has so many philosophical.
Yeah, definitely. That's what I like.
It has so much to it. Noise is a difficult one for us, because it can mean so many different things. In electromagnetics, noise is generally it's not even an unwanted signal, so we call that an interference. But noise is more, you know, what's the smallest signal you can receive inside.
My name is Roman, and I work for the European Space Agency here in Cologne at the European Astronaut Center.
If we are silent in a room, it's still not that silent. If you're in outer space, it's just silent.
On the way to Mars, you would be inside a spaceship. So most of the noise, and it can be quite noisy, would be from the systems around you keeping you alive. 10 years ago, I was selected by the European Space Agency to be part of a crew simulating a trip to Mars. So in other words, I spent 520 days in the mockup of a spaceship. that's something that I don't get asked a lot about the silence in the modules, about noise and silence.
That's astronaut, or rather, Marsonaut, Romain Charles.
Our environment was making some noise. We had ventilation and kind of things. However, it was really quiet. The world was not completely silent from the outside, so we didn't have any direct contact. However, inside our modules, it was, if we talk about silence, becoming more and more present.
So will our children have to travel off Earth to hear silence for the first time? On the International Space Station, the air conditioning is very noisy. It's been a big headache for astronauts, and the latest modules are now much quieter. But here's what Romain Charles has to say about his experience. In fact, the atmosphere became quieter and quieter. He said it was like being in a cocoon.
And throughout the whole year and a half, throughout the whole mission, I could sometimes realize how soft had become, like the talks and the actions. We would try not to make too much sound, too much noise. Little by little, it would become like a habit to be quiet.
Everyone laughed at me when I said I was making a radio feature on silence. An hour long, where will you get the material? But the truth is, I've barely scratched the surface of silence. There are so many more kinds of silence I wish I could have talked about. Ritual silence, the silence of loss, a minute of silence in remembrance of war. Or what about the Japanese concept of ma, which is the interval between things? In music, it means a silence. In a garden, it might mean the space between two stones. This idea also inspired John Cage. You know, that Cage talked about the silence as going on always, whether we listen or not. And he was right. Here is a beautiful poem by Jane Clark.
The pianist. She plays into silence, a harbor at dusk, makes wind ripples over the surface, until her fingers begin to insist, hailstones on the slipway. She dives like a cormorant dives, leaves only a circle of bubbles. We listen for where she'll emerge, taking our breath. She dives again and again, returns us to quietness.
Jane Clark, reading her poem about music and silence. In our noisy, internet-fueled world, we need to take the time to be silent ourselves. As adults, we rarely do this. But let's end with one of my favorite silences. Think back to the time when you were a child and you were falling asleep in the back seat of the car. It was late at night. Maybe there was a light rain, and the windscreen wipers were gently swishing back and forth. Back and forth. That space between the wipers, that was peace. That was the silence in between.